Hi, and welcome to Revision Media with me here tonight, Paul Stevenson, on this Wednesday, the 20th of January, 2021. I'll be live with you here for the next hour, or I should say I won't exactly be live because I've got an interview coming up this evening, and we'll get to that in a couple of minutes, but it's an interview I recorded earlier in the day with Professor Andrew Joyce of the Occidental Observer. But welcome to the show. I hope I find you well in these very precarious times. The days of lockdowns and masks and hypocrisy and audacity at levels we've never witnessed, and just the double standards of these clowns that are coming into the White House on this inauguration day. And I mean, some of the scenes there are just ridiculous. It's just military everywhere. I mean, I don't know where to start, but I'm not going to go too much into it because I want to crack on with the interview. And as I say, that is with Professor Andrew Joyce. He's the author of Talmud and Taboo. He's a prolific writer. He writes for the Occidental Observer and the Occidental Observer Quarterly. The Occidental Quarterly, and we're going to be, you know, he's quite a difficult guy to get, and so I'm thrilled to have him on the show here tonight, or to have interviewed him earlier for airing it on here tonight. So without further ado, we'll just get into it. As I say, that's Andrew Joyce from the Occidental Observer. So this is the interview I did with him earlier today. So it's not out of date. It's not a few days ago. It's exactly about 6 hours ago. So I hope you enjoy that interview. I'm with historian and writer at the Occidental Observer, Andrew Joyce. He's a prolific writer and historian. And I believe that you're also working on a couple of books you mentioned on email. Do you want to just give us a quick analysis of that, Andrew, what the books you're working on, and then we'll get into the other stuff we mentioned?
Well, one is finished and is sitting with Richard Spencer at Washington Summit Publishers. That's just basically a collection of or a volume of essays that I've written that are introduced with a 10,000-word introduction providing an overview of Jewish history. So anyone who's been following any of my writing over the last almost 10 years at the Occidental Observer will be familiar with the type of content that that's going to involve. The second book, which I have an agreement to publish.
And that's Talmud and Taboo, isn't it?
Yes, it's been renamed On the Jews.
Okay.
And the second book, which I've called Foundations of the 21st Century, is and have an agreement to publish with Arctos Publishers, is basically a political philosophy unique to me. It's how I see the world. It's my worldview in total. So there is a chapter in it on Jewish issues, but there's also chapters on, for example, feminism or relations between the sexes, on mass immigration, on economics, on the technology question, and so on and so forth. So that book will basically be, if you have any inclination whatsoever to find out how Andrew Joyce sees the world, some of you will think that that's a good thing. The more sensitive among you might think that my worldview is very twisted indeed. But that will be an insight into sort of a coherent and systematic way of me looking at the world. So it's something very different, and all of that content will be brand new. It's just being a busy man. I try and find as much time as I can for podcasts. I try and find as much time as I can to write essays for the Occidental Observer. And between all of that and the activities and tasks of day-to-day life, it's trying to find time to finish these books. One wishes that one had all the time in the world to complete these things, but being a wage slave, this is the sort of the longer time span that it's taking me to complete these things. So all I will say is stay tuned. It will be published at some point in the future.
All right, Graham, where can we find those books?
Well, the first one isn't published yet that I was talking about, but it will be published by Washington Summit Publishers. The second one will be published by Arctos, who've been publishing a lot of stuff, very, very good stuff recently, and I'll be reviewing some of that shortly for the Occidental Observer. But when they're published, I'll provide all the necessary links through social media and so on, so that people can go and purchase them as soon as possible.
All right. Okay. So the last time we spoke, we were talking about censorship, and we were also talking about Charlottesville. And as I said to you just off air, Charlottesville, the Capitol building is just Charlottesville all over again on steroids, and they're now actually, censoring the not Andrew Joyce, not Paul Stevenson, not E. Michael Jones, but the President of the United States, and that even though I'm aware of Jewish aggression and audacity, that it's just unprecedented this year. Just want to comment on that.
This morning I was having a conversation with Nick Griffin, and we were talking about sort of the assault on big tech. And one of the big things that's happened over the last 4 years that we were discussing is the left wing always did have an unhinged element to it. But over the last 4 years, we saw the start of it with Trump derangement syndrome, but it's reached a hysteria. Now, part of that hysteria is genuine. A lot of the Dems and these liberal types and soy boys do have a feminized nature. They are overly sensitized, and some of the things that Trump has said and some of the ways that that's been twisted in the media to make it look even worse has caused them to have extreme reactions, and they do go into sort of a fearful and emotive panic. But there's also an element that's always been there where there's a kind of knowing hysteria, by which I mean that certain organizations and certain interested parties, and we know who these people and individuals are quite content to act hysterical and to pretend like Nazis are coming down Pennsylvania Avenue. And all of this is with the express intention of shifting the Overton window in their direction, and in, as Kevin McDonald's phrase goes, in shaping ways of seeing. They want the lexicon that we use to describe our politics to shift dramatically in favor of their politics. And one of the offshoots that we've seen recently of all of this activity has been that there has been a change in the terminology from describing our politics simply as bigotry or simply as racism or ignorance, towards describing what we're doing as terroristic, criminal, and so on and so forth. And all of this cultural change, this shaping of ways of seeing, this change in the language, has had the effect of softening up certain bodies, particularly the tech industry, but also, believe you me, it's going to move into the judiciary and into the interpretation of existing laws very, very soon. All of this has the effect of paving the way for mass censorship. And I've noticed in recent years, in particular, I've been writing about it since 2016, probably 2015 actually, is that organizations like the Anti-Defamation League in the United States, organizations like the Community Security Trust in Britain, or the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, or the Board of Deputies of British Jews, or the Council of Germans, Council of Jewish German citizens of the Jewish faith, all of these international bodies are very much interested in censorship, and they've stopped going after individuals and individual videos. I mean, you're talking there earlier, Paul, about how the last podcasts that we recorded on, so one of which was on Jewish history, the other was on sort of Jewish responses to Charlottesville. Those videos were very, very quickly censored on YouTube, and it's actually very difficult for anyone to have an interview with me on YouTube, regardless of how careful and polished my language might be, regardless of how well referenced the things that I'm discussing are. They will be removed very quickly. Well, we've seen an evolution from that stage where videos and people are banned to whole platforms, and indeed the president being banned. So they're not going after Johnny Troll on Twitter anymore. They're basically putting massive pressure on Twitter itself and threatening them with sanctions. Or they're not trying to censor individual users on Parler. They want Parler itself deplatformed. So the scale of censorship has extrapolated massively since Charlottesville. And again, the warnings were made, not many people listened. And unfortunately, as I was tweeting recently, polarization is good if there's a genuine pendulum effect in terms of action between the poles. So you have right-wing action, which provokes a left-wing, a harsh left-wing response, which in turn provokes a right-wing response of equal or more serious gravity. The problem of the last 4 years has been that while Trump has ushered in a period of massive cultural change, and there has been a cultural shift there, almost to the point of there being some kind of revolutionary potential within that great mass of the GOP voter body, what we have actually, and this is disappointingly seen, is that there's kind of been a pendulum between token gestures from the right and massive action from the left. So token gestures on saying we're going to clamp down this on migrants and Trump, you know, with the Muslim ban or whatever. These are kind of token efforts, really, when all is said and done, in terms of how reversible these things are and in terms of how meaningful they are, even at that stage. That swings into massive media overreaction, into massive agitation for legal challenges and so on and so forth. And the right, for the last 4 years, has not been able to swing back the pendulum with anywhere near the force that the left has done. And the result of all of this is that we have a massive body of legitimate voters in the United States who have been more or less declared terroristic, whose politics has been declared beyond the pale. And it's hard to see at the minute, and to be honest, I don't have a totally black-pilled attitude on any of this, actually. I think there's a lot of grounds for optimism. But right now, it's like we're seeing the absolute pinnacle of this upswing in left action. We see Biden come into office. He's put 18 so-called engaged Jews into the cabinet. And by engaged Jews, I would interpret that to mean that they are Zionist, that they are fully on board with the censorship agenda. And these people are occupying positions like the Department for Homeland Security or head of the CIA. They're not messing around anymore. This is a culmination of years of agitation and working, and they have used Trump in a way, the left, and they have, for all the waves that he was creating, they have rode those waves into office, and now it's a kind of wait and see to see how all this unfolds.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt about it. I mean, they have seriously made their move, and as I say, we mentioned the aggression and the speed of it in the last sort of 12 months, and but I think that it could be a good thing. I mean, because you have these institutions being sewn up now, and yet is that voter base that you mentioned, Trump's voter base is a real force, even if, you know, they do get manipulated and Trump has been manipulated. But for every action, there is a reaction. And so they're bringing the fight. I mean, there's been sparring for, you know, it's like it's a boxing match. They've been feeling each other out for 10 rounds, and now it's going into, you know, it's going toe-to-toe. Do you, I mean, I think cessation is something which is possible, because, I mean, I don't know whether I can actually see a civil war. But when you look at the two forces in the United States, just say, we'll look at Europe in a minute, there's no common ground there. And, you know, any civilization, I think, you know, which doesn't even have any ethnic or cultural cohesion, and now just no political cohesion and agreement, you know, how can this continue? You know, something has to give.
Something has to give. But let's go back to this analogy of the boxing match. Right. We do have two broad ideologies. We do have two poles that are coming toe-to-toe. That's true. The problem is that one of the ideologies, one of the opponents, if we stick to this boxing analogy, insists on tying at least one of the hands of the other, of his opponent, behind his back. And this tying is happening in a number of ways. We've got the tax censorship. We've got the kind of, and even within the GOP, there's this kind of establishmentarian agreement that certain subjects and certain actions and certain provocations will now be off limits. And as I said, declared quasi-terroristic, or at least dangerous to the establishment, to the Constitution and what have you. They will portray patriots as unpatriotic. This is the ironic and paradoxical situation which we're now seeing unfolding. But there are other problems afoot. I mean, yes, we can talk about secession. But the most recent news coming out of the Biden camp is that one of his first actions is going to be to grant a massive amnesty, at least to around 11 million migrants. But there are projections that that's going to affect a much larger proportion of, or much higher number, a much higher proportion of the population. And that in turn, there will be a kind of softening of the borders once more, a severe softening of the borders, to the extent that there is within the next 4 years a massive migrant flux into the United States. All of that, and Nick Griffin had pointed this out in an article he wrote in November for the Onze Review called "Wither America: The Moment the Republic Died." Nick Griffin points out that it's not going to be the blue states that all of these migrants are going to gain their citizenship. All these Mexicans are going to be in places like Texas or New Mexico, a lot of the red states, and automatically, and it's not dyed in the wool. Not all of the Mexicans are going to vote Democrat, because some of them, because of hostility towards abortion, for example, will vote Republican. That will continue, but they'll vote for a Republicanism that's kind of anodyne, that's kind of bleached of any ethnic patriotism, of course. So even when they vote Republican, it will be with a soft edge. But predominantly, I think we can agree that most of these new migrants will vote Democrat. They'll vote with the welfare budgets. They'll vote with what the material provisions can be provided to them. So they may, very well may become a massive Democrat voting base within the red states. So the red states, in terms of their being able to vote themselves into a state of secession, or even push themselves onwards towards some kind of state of civil war. And I'm not saying that a civil war would even be the best idea, to be honest. But I don't think it's going to be cut and dry. I don't think that yes, there's definitely a massive competition going on at the minute between ideologies, but I think it's quite nuanced, and I think that there are no easy ways of disentangling ourselves from some of these complexities.
You mentioned there earlier that people didn't listen. A century ago, Henry Ford wrote the book The International Jew, and no one listened then either. And he talks in here about audacity. Is it as simple as extracting Jewish power and influence from Western civilization? Because to me, that would seem to really, create an opportunity for stability, because I mean they are the people who are causing the destruction, and yet no one mentions them. And Henry Ford's warned about this a year ago or a century ago, and people still aren't mentioning the Jewish influence.
Yeah, I mean, let's get back, let's strip back to basics first of all. When we talk about Jewish influence in Western societies, Jews possess a, let's just say Jews possess a certain suite of characteristics. One of which is as Kevin MacDonald has pointed out, psychological aggression, and the other being above average intelligence. Both of those things mean that they are very efficient workers in obtaining and acquiring power. Together, of course, with ethnocentrism, because then it's a team effort. So those things automatically mean that you have, given that these Jews, possess a contrary ideology, shall we say, and then in conjunction with those characteristics, then you have a very, very capable opponent. And when they're particularly adept at wealth acquisition and obtaining resources, your problems multiply further. So whenever we talk about removing Jewish influence or challenging it, Jewish influence is always, yes, it's standalone, but it's always integrated into a wider system, because Jews themselves are a numerically small element of the population. That is primarily throughout historical time been their weakness. And so they rely on networks of allies, normally elite allies. When the elites let them down, as they did at the in Russia at the end of the 20th century, then they forged new allies, so that could be through a communist elite or an entirely different elite. But they're quite fluid in strategies. And when I say strategies, I don't mean that they gather in meeting rooms and come up with a set of protocols of what to do in that particular year. But what I do mean is that even on an individual basis, an ideological Jew will know what's in his best interests and will aggressively pursue them. Now, if we were be able to, if we were able to click our fingers and remove the likes of, well, he's now removed himself, I suppose, or death has Sheldon Adelson from the equation, you'll still be left with the structure in which Jews are integrated. And it is an unfortunate fact that although we are in opposition to very much of what Jews are doing in modern society, that there is a systemic problem, and that there are people, and people like Edward Dutton have described them as mutants. They are sort of these maladaptive people who over time have come to adopt these spiteful attitudes towards the healthy and the normal and the beautiful. These people will still exist, and they will still have a kind of revolutionary potential within them as well, a tendency towards degradation, a tendency towards the fomenting of decline in culture and so on. But certainly, when we look at some of the most harmful aspects of what's affecting society right now, which would be the rampant consumerism, the debt-based culture, pornography, and the general decline of morals, there's little point in denying that Jews have been being themselves highly intelligent and aggressive at the forefront of so many of these moves. So again, I would have to answer that question with some nuance and say, even if we could click our fingers and remove every stridently ideological, committed and highly identified Jew, that we would still have some way to go to fixing the deep existential problems that have racked Western civilization, probably since the French Revolution.
Yeah, because the system is so badly infected now that even if you remove the problem, it would still be sick, if I can use that kind of analogy. It would eventually probably recover, but it would take a lot of time, basically. If you could point to a period in history as to when as the pivotal turning point for the decline and the destruction that Western civilization has seen, what would it be? Would it be the Federal Reserve coming into the United States?
It would be hard to pinpoint a certain stage or a certain year at which the decline really began. I believe certainly in the broad view that a lot of our modern problems can be traced to the mass migration of Ashkenazi Jews from the Russian Empire to the West, to the United States and elsewhere, beginning really in the 1880s and ending about 30 years later. During that time, you basically have a massive objective social problem that had made a nuisance of itself in the Russian Empire for at least a century or two. And it undergoes a massive demographic boom. It's well trained in things like money lending and credit and sort of, I suppose, cultural manipulation, you could say, in a way, and in the forging of ties with elites. And for various reasons, one of which is that they kind of outgrow their own resources, we get these pogrom narratives which emerge, some of which are justified, many of which, and most of which are not justified, and are in fact complete inventions and embellishments, riding a crest of manufactured sympathy. Millions upon millions of these Jews migrate to the West, and once there, some of them involve themselves in starting to promote Bolshevism. Others begin selling pornography, and just generally involving themselves in the trade and vice. In the growth of their financial power. The second generation moves into the professions. They have a devastating effect in academia. They have a devastating effect once they get into the media and acquire newspapers and control over television stations. And they push their own political agenda. And that political agenda isn't strictly left or right, because as we've seen with the Trump and Biden changeover, the one thing that hasn't changed, despite this superficial sea change between left and right, one thing that hasn't changed is that the administration remains Zionist. It remains committed to censorship of opinions beneficial to the native white majority of the United States. And, there's a certain core set of interests and goals which will continue to be adhered to. And I remember years ago, I think it was during the Nathan Kaufness affair. Kaufness was making the argument that there are no such thing as Jewish interests, or at least he was saying that Kevin MacDonald, and saying that the work of the Frankfurt School, for example, could not be perceived as being in tune with Jewish interests, because certain, you know, promoting communism, he was saying, wasn't in tune with Jewish interests. But these are all superficial matters of nomenclature and terminology. When you actually scratch beneath the surface, there are no contradictions, no paradoxes, and in actual fact, there's this very, very steady adherence to core principles within the Jewish community. And any native white American or European or Australian or what have you, in trying to push for their interests, is naturally, it's not even a conscious engagement in hostility. They're just naturally going to come into conflict with contrary ideologies, with contrary interests and goals. I mean, I wrote a few months ago a long essay, nearly 9,000 words, on the merits and inadequacies of this middleman minority theory in explaining the Jews. And one of the founders of that theory, in actual fact, in the late 1960s, early 70s, a Marxist American historian called Edna Banasich, and she was Jewish. She said that, you know, there, you can come up with all kinds of explanations you want for the phenomena like anti-Semitism. You can say that it's self-generated, but really it's quite clear to see that what's going on here is a clash of interests, and it's not particularly the fault of any one people. It's just that there is a clash of interests. Jews have separate goals from us. They have separate things that will benefit them. We can go back to Barbara Roach, for example, the politician in Tony Blair's Labour government, who said that she just felt safer and more at home in a multicultural street in London than she would if it was all white people.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a kind of a naturalistic way of looking at it. It's just that this is the way things are.
Yeah, whatever's in their interest. It was interesting that Douglas Murray mentioned Barbara Roche, and he identified her as a Jew as well, and then backed off from it. But anyway, he's done. His work though is worthwhile, I think. Some of the work Douglas Murray's done, you know.
Like a lot of gatekeepers, Douglas Murray is useful only insofar as he doesn't close the door.
Yeah.
Someone moving on further. And the problem with a lot of gatekeepers, and you'll find this normally with sort of free speech types, is you'll get someone who comes up. I mean, in the UK, they have this Lawrence Fox guy, and that Lawrence Fox will say controversial things about transsexuals, and he'll say controversial things about sort of woke diversity and British period dramas appearing on the TV.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Lawrence Fox himself has come out and declared other opinions to be beyond the pale. So that's a gatekeeper that's useless. That's a gatekeeper that will funnel votes into something that's not going to go anywhere. That's someone who is trying to protect his own little niche and make some money by delineating the fact that he is not X, Y, or Z. He is saying, I want free speech to be able to say this, but we should all agree that we shouldn't give free speech to these people.
Yeah.
So Douglas Murray, I've always perceived in that way. Added to the fact that he's, you know, he's, shall we say, one of them.
yeah.
You know, I don't know. The Strange Death of Europe is a good book. Don't get me wrong. It's a fast, easy, punchy, good book. I haven't read The Madness of Crowds. I have no inclination or intention of doing so. But certainly The Strange Death of Europe is a good gateway book, as I said in my review. My problem with Murray is just that I see him increasingly as someone who is a dead-end gateway.
Yeah, well, there's quite a few of them, and as you say, they believe in free speech, you know, and unless it gets, how should you put it, you know, too edgy or unpalatable, and then, you know, they'll be quite quick to throw you under the bus at that point.
Oh yeah.
Right. You mentioned there that you were speaking to Nick Griffin about tactics and stuff, so we could touch on that. I'll just quote Ford. It says at his time, Judah has begun the struggle. Judah has made the invasion. Let it come. Let no man fear it. But let every man insist that the fight be fair. Let college students and leaders of thought know that the objective is the Regnancy of the ideas and the race that have built all the civilization we see and that promises all the civilization of the future. Let them also know that the attacking force is Jewish. That is all that will be necessary. It is against this that the Jew protests. You must not identify us. They say, you must not use the term Jew. Why? Because unless the Jewish idea can creep in under the assumption of other than Jewish origin, it is doomed. Now, so he said that is all will be necessary. Have we gone beyond that because of what we said about their entanglement and the wider systematic and institutions of Western civilization, or what did you and Nick Griffin come up with?
Well, I mean, we were talking tactics in general, I suppose, rather than Jewish matters specifically. But what you've quoted there from Ford, and it's been a long time since I read Ford, but what he says there is very, very strikingly similar, in fact, to what Hilaire Belloc writes in The Jews. Now, I think Henry Ford might have published The International Jew maybe in 1920, maybe 1921. Hilaire Belloc publishes The Jews in 1922. In a lot of ways, it's a more sober, more reflective book, and probably a better book, to be honest. It's certainly one of the best books on the subject that I've read. Not many people have read it. I did do a very long, I think almost 10,000-word review of it for the Occidental Observer because it was on sale for a time as part of Amazon's Forgotten Books series, so it was back in print. I think that my review actually may have prompted certain bodies to put pressure on Amazon to remove it from print. So I'm not actually sure. So when we finish this conversation, perhaps go and look it up, or I certainly will just out of curiosity to see if it's still for sale. But in The Jews, Belloc does say that one of the fundamental ways of moving forward from the sort of the anti-Semitic state of affairs, this he describes it as a tension or a friction in society between Jews that is natural between them and the host population. He said the only way to remove this isn't through sort of expulsion and segregation and all these different things. It's simply to get things, to throw them all forward, to cast them all in front of you, to ventilate them and let a discussion take place about the friction, rather than always covering it up, which builds tension and which must itself eventually escape. And normally, because it's bottled up for so long, it escapes in very dramatic and often violent fashion. This was Belloc's theory. So what Ford and Belloc are both saying there is that we need sort of public discussion. We need to be able to say, look, you know, in the context of major mainstream media, to be able to have a debate and say, is it healthy, for example, that Biden has already 18 confirmed, quote unquote, engaged Jews in the cabinet? You know, a massive overrepresentation relative to their numbers in the population. Perhaps not so overrepresented when we look at who's sort of in charge of the finances and who's really influential in America. But that influence in itself, we need to put back into perspective and say, is this desirable? Is this good? Is it good that we have this ongoing commitment to Israel? Is it good that we have so many of our media executives preaching diversity, yet in themselves as viewed as a community, not diverse in the slightest? They're all part of the same Ashkenazi ethnic group. Many of them intermarried or interrelated. So there is something to be said for that. Yes, in an ideal world, that would be a good idea. That would be something worth doing. But we should always come back to the fact that these writers were writing a century ago.
Yeah.
And they were writing at a time where certain laws, which are now in place, did not exist. They were writing at a time when you could say certain things and make certain proposals without fear of either massive social ostracism or the threat of imprisonment. We're facing all of those things and more. So simply going around and saying we need to be able to chat about the Jews is not going to affect anything anymore. We are long past that stage. And it may well be that in dealing with the issue of Jewish influence, we have to go around the subject. It may be so impossible to go through it anymore. And this doesn't mean that we all stop talking about Jews. This doesn't mean that we don't write about the history, that we don't analyze the contemporary situation. There will always be a place for webzines like the Occidental Observer or individual people like David Duke or what have you, or E. Michael Jones, who want to say what they want to say about Jews. There will always be a place for that. But in terms of creating mass movement, or channeling mass energy of the type that Trump has managed to almost inadvertently, let's face it, because his actual concrete policies can't really be held responsible for the massive enthusiasm that he's got. It's a
No,
lot of it's to do with it's part personality, it's part bottled up desire among the American population just to see someone like Trump. And so a lot of projections onto his personality and onto him and what he's done has taken place. There's a lot of projection there.
I'm really glad you said that, actually. It's a really good point, because I couldn't agree more. But it's almost by accident, or just cult of personality, that he has just had this mood, this bottled up tension and anger and frustration just projected onto one man whose ego loves it.
So it's, I mean, that because accident or not, what Trump has done is he has created a kind of revolutionary pool of anticipation and latent action, which has not been channeled so far into anything ultimately productive. Now, the question then, if we come back to what we're talking about, is the way forward for that massive pool of people to go to them and say, we need to start talking about Jews? I'm not convinced. There are a number of overlapping problems there. Some of them will have a religious affinity with Jews, based on all kinds of corruptions from their scriptures and so on and so forth. And on top of that, there is a massive cultural indoctrination project which has been ongoing for a long time, really since the Second World War, which has made those ideas the ultimate taboo. So when you're trying to bring those people down a path, you don't hit them with the final destination straight away. They have a bit to go on the journey before they get to that stage. So we need to figure out what are the other landmarks on the journey that they need to reach. And that's part of the problem. The other problem is that at the minute there is this massive pool of revolutionary potential, but it's very delicate and it's quite dissolvable, and it could once again just disappear into a massive silent, so-called silent majority. So what do you do there? You have to solidify it. And what Nick Griffin has suggested in his article that was published at the Ons Review in November is that there needs to be a real solid grassroots connected movement built on kind of upper working class people. He's talking about the or lower middle class, the truck drivers, the farmers. Now, the people whose interests are under attack. I mean, you've got these truck drivers who are often self-employed, who are ambitious people, prudent and sober for the most part, hardworking, who have a potential to be kind of leaders at the local scene. And their jobs are under threat. Their jobs are under threat from technologization. They're talking about moving the entirety of the trucking industry into kind of automated trucking. Now, how far away that is difficult to say at this stage, but it's coming down the line. And what that will do is it will, America, I don't know if you've ever been there, but I lived there for long periods, and you need to drive almost everywhere you go. And everything relies on driven freight in terms of delivering groceries and so on and so forth, and supplies and raw materials. Truck drivers are a massive element of the sort of lower middle class with America. It's a way for relatively uneducated people to make a decent salary. And when their jobs go, it will be a kind of another massive blow to the white population. So there's a core of potential there, and ditto for the farmers. I mean, we've got this climate change nonsense which just keeps escalating in all different directions. There's this anti-meat drive where they're wanting us to move on to a diet of bugs and so on. And some of it's been overplayed, and some of it is kind of pipe dream thinking on the part of the left, but it's still there, and it's an antagonism, and it's kind of black propaganda against farmers. So there is a potential there, but it's hard to bring those people along further along the journey, and it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be quick, but there are grounds for optimism in the fact that we're against a very obvious and very radical left government now. Whereas with Trump, you're moving through mud. You're surrounded by you're just in a thicket of conflicting ideologies. You've got all kinds of right-wing patriotism that are shot through with Zionism and other kinds of kind of wokeness and promoting gays in Africa and all the rest of it. So we're out of the thicket now. We should be able to see things clearer, and that is a grounds for optimism.
The other, of course, the other big difference and challenge that that the writers of Bullock and Ford didn't have to face at that time is, of course, the huge demographic shifts that we're now facing.
that has occurred in since that century. I mean, it's demographically unrecognizable from a century ago, both in Europe and the West, or in the United States.
And it's accelerating. I mean, I saw a couple of tweets recently, which I agreed with, and then I tweeted myself saying basically, look, there's no immediate way that we're going to be able to stop Biden from going ahead with this amnesty and amnestying so many millions of illegal immigrants and then basically softening up the borders to allow in millions more. Some people are saying there could be 40 to 50, it could affect 40 to 50 million people and coming into America or acquiring citizenship and so on. And equally, with events now in the UK where they're talking about granting residency status to over 5 million Hong Kong Chinese overnight, and in addition to the fact that immigration has not slowed one bit under the
Accelerated,
Conservatives, in fact, accelerated, and we see the same issues in Germany and France and so on, all the way through the European continent, except the kind of the Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic. That sort of little grouping off towards the east. But the rest of us have been very, very badly affected. There's no immediate way that we're going to be able to stop this. That's not a black pill. That's just basically accepting reality is that there are no laws going to be passed within the next year that stop that happening. So it's coming. So strategically, as a movement and I suppose as a culture, we're a culture as much or a subculture as much as a political movement at the minute. There needs to be a conversation that moves increasingly in the direction of kind of white entrenchment, or if you don't, some people even in our circles don't like the view of us all as just white, but as in terms of our individual nationalism as well, view an entrench. What does an entrenchment of the English look like? What does an entrenchment of the Scots or the Irish or the Welsh or the French or the Germans? What does it look like? We need to have those conversations because pipe dreams about an instantaneous Reconquista, in the present context,
are a waste of time.
at best wishful thinking, at worst a waste of time. Exactly.
What else did, so let's just look at Europe then. What did you and Nick Griffin come up with regards to Europe?
Well, Nick, I mean, I'm going to try and get a hold of the book, but Nick actually, he showed me a book that he's written called Deus Vult, something like the Return to a Muscular Christianity. Nick's own worldview is sort of
Is he a
refracted
Christian?
through the lens of Christianity. There's nothing wrong with that.
Is he a Christian?
He is, yes. And he's been heavily involved with the kind of the Christian patriot movements throughout continental Europe. And he is stripping it right back to basics in terms of what does the most grassroots level of white activism looks like? And it's very, very basic stuff. I mean, he was talking about food banks and charity shops and mother and baby groups, people who kind of assist each other with providing each other with furniture or finding somewhere to live, your community support that slowly builds up to political structure, that slowly builds up to lobbying groups, but not with a heavy emphasis on political parties. Nick was saying that, look, political parties in the present context, and he was saying this, of course, as Britain's most electorally successful far-right politician ever. He was saying, look, the electoral angle, I've been down further than anyone else. Eventually, you get to a certain point of success where the state will try and destroy the party by destroying its reputation. So the two main parties will just gang up on that upcoming third party. So this is the first strategy. And of course, in 2004, the BBC, assisted by the British state, put in a secret agent for a documentary called The Secret Agent, in which they sent someone to BNP meetings with a little recording camera on their lapel of their jacket, so they could record a few drunks saying a couple of controversial things on camera, and then they tried to expose it to the world. So this was the first big strategy to disrupt the upcoming BNP, but it had the opposite effect. I think the BNP, after the documentary came out, lost something like 11 or 14 members, but they gained over 1,000 within the first week of the documentary showing. So people were actually enthused by what they saw. They felt sympathy for the BNP and the way it had been infiltrated. And it was viewed by something like 4 million people. And one of those 4 million people was myself. I was a teenager at the time. And it switched me on to Nick Griffin. It switched me on to the BNP. So that didn't work. Well, 2 years later, massive backing appears out of nowhere for Nigel Farage to become leader of UKIP. And UKIP is the kind of the Trojan horse that comes in. It diverts a lot of voting energy and middle class sensibility from the BNP in towards UKIP. And the BNP basically dies through that form of kind of controlled opposition, whatever you want to call it, you know, a diversionary process that is put in place. So there are a number of strategies that existing establishmentarian parties can put in place to crush an up-and-comer. And this is the challenge that faces any up-and-coming electoral party from the right, from the real right. So Griffin was basically saying, look, going forward, yes, have your political parties, but don't put all your eggs in that basket. They are just kind of a veneer. I don't want to be too cynical in saying that it gives a veneer of respectability, because our politics are respectable, but you know what I mean. It's a kind of anchor or focal point around which the real movement can orbit. And that, in a nutshell, was Nick Griffin's philosophy. It's what he's outlined in this book. I'm going to try and get a hold of the book so that I can read it, possibly review it for the Occidental Observer, and give his ideas a sort of a wider airing, certainly in the United States, where the focus of the movement is predominantly on this kind of online quasi-entertainment / social media scene, and outside of which is very little. I know that there's the National Justice Party, which has been founded by Mike Enoch and his circle, and fair play to them for doing that. But I think that Griffin's ideas would do well with the hearing in the United States. But due to the nature of how you become, I suppose, popular within the American scene, Griffin either isn't that well known, because the movement tends to be, certainly is now younger than it ever has been, and a lot of people are just so young that they weren't politically active at the time that Nick Griffin was most active, now sort of 15 to 17 years ago. So they're like, who's Nick Griffin? So I think it falls upon those of us who are younger and who do remember the contributions that Nick Griffin made to revisit him and give a wider hearing to his ideas to other people who would benefit from it.
Yeah, and you mentioned you know, Christianity. I mean, it's very, very challenging for me as a Christian to be a Christian in these times, because the church, that's another institution or whatever you want to call it, which has been badly infiltrated, stroke infected. And I'm not just talking about the Catholic Church. I mean, I went to a little local church near where I live so I could have a bit of fellowship with some Christians. And the ignorance is just off the chart. The exegesis of the scriptures is awful. And these people, I told them, I warned them not to go into lockdown, to take a stand and to take what was coming, so that they could be seen to take a stand, because people don't understand the economic catastrophe which is coming down the tracks. I warned the church not to go into this lockdown and to take a stand. But not only are they just overwhelmingly ignorant, but they just lack any sort of spine as well. I mean, these are not people to be going into battle with, spiritual or otherwise. And one of the guys was, you know, the elder in the church was doing a talk on racism in the church. And he had his back up because some white Christian, apparently, that he had heard about, that didn't want his daughter marrying a black guy. And of course, you see, this was all accepted as, like, you know, let's get rid of racism in the church, until they made the mistake of inviting me to that meeting. And I told them, I said, first of all, it's none of your business. What gives you the right to think that some other guy, what he does with his daughter? And I said, secondly, is it just that you left your own land and of your own free will to come to another man's land for a better life? Did you not come here for selfish reasons? Where is the injustice? And this is where the way the church needs to think. And one of the guys said to me, I'm not going there. I said, well, you are going there. You're the one that brought up the discussion on racism. In fact, it was the pastor said to me, we're not going there. But this is what you're dealing with. I mean, these guys are clowns. They've got Marxist ideas in the church. They don't stand for it. And what I realized was, you know, because they wouldn't take a stand for the church, they certainly wouldn't take a stand for the white race, because they would say, oh, we're Christians, that's racism. Talk on racism in the church, you know.
Yeah.
And he was upset because some white guy didn't want his daughter, some Christian didn't want his daughter marrying a black guy. And they probably weren't expecting, you know, they probably thought they were going to jump through the hoops of how racist this was and how unchristian this was, because you get this all the time, you know. They're always trying to tie your hands behind your back if you're a Christian. And I said to him, first of all, it's none of your business what a guy does with his wife. what with his daughter. And I said, secondly, you left Ghana of your own free will to come to another man's land without consulting him or asking him so you could have a better life. I said, so don't sit there whinging about your hard life and about racism in the church. And, you know, it all kind of kicked off, you know, yeah. And quite frankly, and the relationships were never really repaired because the guy, I when I said that they were, you know, outside of what would be considered Christian by selfishly leaving their land to go to another man's land for their own benefit. And then they come complaining. And I pointed out this wasn't very Christian. They said, oh, we're not going there. And I said, well, because you're not having a discussion on racism. You're having a discussion on Western cultural Marxism, you know. So, I mean, the church is a very lonely place to be, you know.
Of course. I recently reviewed a book by Julien Langella, a French Catholic associated with, or one of the founders, actually, of Generation Identity over there. And in his book, Catholic and Identitarian, he gets into the kind of the nitty-gritty of how he views his church as being, you know, completely overrun with these kind of ideologies. There are one or two exceptions to the rule, but the fact is that the rule is quite depressing indeed. And as you say, they engage in all of these sort of diversionary strategies. I mean, I was recently reading a review of, because I'm talking about The Merchant of Venice later, a review of the movie The Merchant of Venice with Al Pacino. One of the reviewers had said that there's clearly been a lot of sort of diversionary strategies employed here in trying to get away from the fact that in the play, Shylock is a very unpleasant person. Well, I think that when in a lot of the churches, I mean, there's a lot of diversionary strategies to get away from any of the kind of national or even anti-Jewish content that's in the Bible. So, you know, things are being sort of worked on an ad hoc basis in order to construct all ideologies, whether it's religion or politics, around the interests of the group that we keep talking about. So, yeah, it is a depressing state of affairs, but it's going to be incumbent on people like yourselves, as opposed to keep pushing at that door until it gives way.
Yeah, and I warned them not to go into lockdown. I remember talking to them about Bolshevism and what happened in Russia in the 20th century to Christians to try and get their attention. And I said to them, do not go into lockdown. Do not give up more ground. I said, the church has given up ground all the time, and just stand your ground and let the persecution come. But they wouldn't listen, and they sort of did a lot of you know, exegetical gymnastics, which I rebuked about, you know, because they say, oh, we must obey the authorities. And then they leave out. Conveniently leave out the next passage that Paul says what the legitimate role of the authorities is to keep law and order. And that is it. Nothing to do with public health, nothing to do with telling you what you can do in your church and whether you should go to church. But they don't stand for anything. And what I realized is none of these guys who are white are going to like get into the white guy thing, because they'll say, oh, well, that's racist and we're really good Christians. But what I realized then is that people who don't stand for anything don't stand for anything.
Yeah.
You know? They wriggled out of standing up for Christianity when it came to it. You know, it was very, very demoralizing, quite frankly. But is there anything else you want to just add, Andrew? And then I'll let you go. And thank you for joining me.
Just to say that it's been a pleasure once again, Paul, to speak with you. I'm sorry we haven't been able to speak more frequently, but it is always a pleasure. We always get down to the real meat and bones of the problems that we're facing whenever we do speak. So I look forward, whenever it happens again, to speaking with you.
Yeah, you too, and take care, and you know, and blessings to you and your family, and we'll keep in touch on email as ever, you know.
Thanks, Paul. Bye.
Thanks, Andrew. Take care. Bye. All right. Well, there goes Andrew Joyce. Andrew Joyce is, you know, he's just a really impressive guy. Go and read his articles. I mean, the research of, you know, the amount of time and effort and documentation that goes into the research of these guys, when you think of some of the clowns that they put forth these days as journalists and journalism, and then you read articles from Andrew Joyce and Tobias Langdon and others, and most others who do proper journalism. This is the irony. They document things. They present arguments which are, in most cases, unequivocal. And then you have these clowns on the left accusing such as fake news, conspiracy theories. But alas, that's the world we live in. You know, it's very Orwellian.
But that's Andrew Joyce. He's a great guy. He's got integrity. And apart from being a great writer, he's got great character. There's a lot of people want to get a hold of Andrew recently because he's kind of he hasn't been doing many podcasts, and so I'm very chuffed really that we were able to get him on here tonight on Revision Media. Hopefully, we can get him on again at least once this year. He's always been upfront about, you know, when he can or when he will or what's going on. But you can check out his work at the Occidental Observer and on Twitter as well. I'm not really sure. I meant to get his Twitter address, but I'll try and find it for the link when I put the video together on YouTube. And you can find the link for his Twitter account on YouTube, on my YouTube channel. Which is Paul Edward Stevenson. Or you can just, like, you know, check it out yourself, see if you can find it. I meant to get it off him earlier, but I didn't. But it was great to speak to him again. It was good for morale for me personally. He is a leader. And he's the kind of guy that we need here in the West and in the current climate that we're facing. So, again, really glad to get him on. The Occidental Observer is where you'll find his articles. In-depth, fascinating articles. And I would encourage anybody to go and read them. And also, you know, a lot of the stuff at the Occidental Observer, I mean, they're not anti-Christian there, which is great as well. So, yeah, I will wrap it up there. I'll be back next Wednesday here on Revision Media. I'll also be live with Richard Carey on Beyond the Official Narrative. I'm there every Monday as a co-host with Richard at 12 p.m. Central Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Here in the UK. So until then, folks, have a great week and take care and God bless you.